Before we start today, I want to let you know that this episode discusses sensitive topics, including suicide, self-harm, and descriptions of involuntary psychiatric treatment. I just want to give you a heads up so that you can exercise discretion about whether or not to listen. You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. You don't have to be a pop music fan to know that Britney Spears' conservatorship was ended last Friday. While that hearing was going on in LA, activists here were saying, it's not just Britney. Forced treatment can be nightmarish.
I had experienced physical restraint with the leather restraints, and there were a number of times I felt that I had been chemically restrained to the point I was a zombie and really did not have much awareness of what was going on at the time.
But local legislators have said that the threshold for forcing someone to accept treatment is too high and tried to expand the conditions under which certain people can be conserved.
I believe that there are people who cannot take care of themselves, and that when people can't take care of themselves, we are obligated to take care of them.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic.
What do we want?
Mental health services.
When do we want it?
Now!
Louder!
While this small demonstration was going on out in front of Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, a lot of people were thinking about mental health and conservatorship because of Britney Spears. A judge was in the process of ending her conservatorship. There are a few different kinds of conservatorship, but broadly speaking, it's a state under which a conservator makes certain decisions for the conservatee. This happens when someone is deemed not able to take care of themselves. Britney's case has obviously gotten a lot of attention because she's a celebrity. But the demonstrators here were saying it's not just her. And they're right. In San Francisco, more than 600 people at last count were under conservatorship by the county, and that doesn't include people conserved by private individuals. Conservatorship has many different aspects. Today, we'll hear from mental health and disability rights advocates, someone who's been a conservator and who helps shape local policy, and someone who's a coordinator for peer mental health services. I just want to acknowledge that there are more perspectives out there and more people who play different roles in this system, and I'm hoping we can bring you their views on a future show on this issue. The activists out in front of the hospital last week described the psychiatric emergency unit there as a pipeline to conservatorship and institutionalization. I sent an invitation to the hospital spokesperson to see if we could talk with someone who works in psychiatry there, but I didn't hear back. Here's Rhea Small with Senior in Disability Action, describing why they chose this location.
We believe that no one should have their rights taken away, and everyone should get the kind of treatment that they want. We're outside of SF General because many people start the conservatorship process here. The hospital should be a safe place to access care, and not a place to fear being restrained or involuntarily confined.
Orson Wagon is homeless at the moment.
I was conserved as a minor by my mother, and I was in one lockup. I didn't know my brother was in another one. And I was conserved and sent to a county facility where a lot of people from jail were in for the criminally insane. And I didn't know at the time that I'm on the spectrum of autism. So they sent me to an all schizophrenic sanitarium, even though I don't believe in schizophrenia. But nobody could really talk. It was very abusive. And I was there until I was almost 19. I got out of there. Well, when I got out, I was a homeless with 50 cents. They pulled me off all the medicine and said, well, you don't need this anymore now that you're not in here. A few years ago, I have complex traumas is why, and I live in an RV and I've been in there since the Trump administration. My homelessness is connected to the mental health system.
Conservatorship is really viewed as a last resort. One intervention that's much more common is involuntary psychiatric holds. These are known as 5150s for their California code section, and they can be traumatic, as Cheryl Block Shanks said at the protest.
I was 5150 about 9 times before I really got help that I needed. I was right here at General in St. Luke's, a dependent. They'd strap me down and they'd shoot me up. Oh my God. I'd wake up in the morning and I would see the therapist for about 3 minutes. She would evaluate me and diagnose me what kind of medication I needed. That went on for a couple of years. However, I was one of the lucky ones where the doctor took interest in me. And I was one of the lucky ones that actually got the mental health I needed. Why did I have to be lucky? Everybody should be able to access the mental health they need. It shouldn't have to be lucky.
The demonstrators, who call themselves the Mad Mob, are a subgroup of the organization Senior and Disability Action. They want to see an expansion of voluntary treatment options and affordable housing. And they say if everyone had stable and affordable housing, as well as access to quality health care, including voluntary mental health treatment that works for them, there wouldn't be any need for conservatorship. They also pointed to the alternative framework of supported decision-making, when people with disabilities choose a trusted friend or loved one or professional as their supporter. Here's David Elliott Lewis, a mental health advocate, on the Mad Mob's origin and mission.
And our guiding principle, which overlaps with the whole reason we're doing this, is this statement: nothing about us without us. I'm going to say that again. Nothing about us without us, which means the treatment we receive, the medications we receive, if any, the therapy we receive, we need to have a say in whether we receive it and how we receive it and what we receive. We need to have agency and voice in the decisions that treat us.
At Friday's protest, the Mad Mob members held signs that said conservatorship is toxic and mad pride. They were calling for the abolition of conservatorship. District 8 Supervisor Raphael Mandelman is strongly opposed to that idea.
I think the position of those advocates is untenable and wrong and, in my view, verging on immoral. Because I believe that there are people who cannot take care of themselves, and that when people can't take care of themselves, we are obligated to take care of them. And I think we recognize that certainly for folks under 18, but I think there are folks, not a lot, but some who are over the age of 18 and not yet very old seniors who are not able to manage their affairs, who are, again, either creating such great challenges for the community in which they live or for themselves that I think most reasonable people would agree that person shouldn't be making decisions for themselves for some period of time. And it's a thing we can disagree on. You know, right now we can serve something like, I think, several hundred people a year in San Francisco. I think we have a very high bar here. I think the bar is too high. I think there are more people who are out there who need public health intervention, who need decisions about things like medication and housing made for them. And that's not everyone on the street. It's not even the majority of folks on the street. I think it's a minority of the folks who are out on the street. But there are some, and I see them. We all see them. People who, you know, really cannot manage on their own, but are absolutely not interested in coming indoors and or getting help. And, you know, for some folks, that's fine. Some folks are living outdoors fine and there's no issue. And for some folks, they're landing themselves in jail and or the hospital. And, you know, we should try to stop that.
What do you think people should do when they see somebody who appears to be in distress? Because again, from the advocate side, we don't have time to get into the whole conversation about law enforcement involvement, but sometimes that does happen. And people are saying, you know, if you see someone in mental distress, ask them what they need. And if they don't engage, just leave them alone. Because if you, you know, call someone, it may result in law enforcement contact, and that can be traumatic.
I think it depends on what the person is doing. If the person is doing something that is actually destructive and frightening, is assaulting or seem like they're about to assault someone, breaking windows, then I think you call 911. If it's someone who's doing something that is dangerous to themselves, they are physically harming themselves in a way that is obvious. They're walking into traffic. Again, call 911. Happily, in San Francisco, you know, when you call 911, the 911 operator may have the ability to access a non-police response that is pretty effective. You know, a team that's out of the public health department, the fire department, that'll go out and engage with the person, not from a police perspective. But even if it's the police who are going out, San Francisco police officers, you know, are trained on how to engage with folks who are suffering from mental illness. And I think in many of those situations, it would be best not to have a police officer there at all. But if, you know, if the only person available is a police officer and that person is threatening to others or to themselves, you know, I think sometimes it's appropriate to get a police officer out there.
He has personal experience with conservatorship, having become his mother's conservator.
It was difficult for me and my mother, mainly because I was relatively young and I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And trying to, you know, do stuff in Orange County courts when I was up here, and it was a process. But she never objected to it. So that made it relatively easy. And I was doing it as part of an overall effort to like kind of manage some money that she had inherited from her mother when her mother died, and put it, get into a special needs trust to ensure that she would have some resources at least for the rest of her life and wouldn't lose her Medi-Cal and other benefits through that anyway. So it was not the situation of which so many families of mentally ill folks face, where the person who needs the help is rejecting and resisting it. This was not contested. It wasn't hard. It is very hard. And families of folks with mental illness will tell you, they see their loved ones self-destructing on the streets, repeatedly being hospitalized, going to jail, but cannot themselves obtain a conservatorship and cannot get government to get a conservatorship over that person. And I think that's wrong.
He was also an advocate for San Francisco to enact a state law at the local level that was supposed to expand the options for the use of conservatorship in certain cases. This was SB 1045, and locally it's referred to as the Housing Conservatorship Program, a pilot program. The idea was to get people living on the streets and cycling between psychiatric emergency services and the streets, with maybe incarceration as well, into housing and treatment. To qualify under the program, someone needed to be placed on 8 or more psychiatric holds, or 5150s, in a year. There are several thresholds in this program set really high, and as of October, only 2 people have been conserved under this pilot program. 8 involuntary psychiatric holds in a year is pretty exceptional.
That's a lot of 5150s in any given year, and that's concerning with these individuals that are being 5150 that often. There must be something else going on, and there must be some other way to address their particular issues.
This is Eric Henriquez from a conversation that we had almost 2 years ago in February 2020. The new pilot program under SB 1045 had been approved by the Board of Supervisors the summer before. So nobody knew then how few people exactly would be conserved under the new rules, although there were already estimates that just a small handful would even meet the thresholds. Eric works for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. At the time, he was peer provider manager for the Marin Crisis Consortium, and he's now director of peer services. And decades ago, Eric himself was conserved.
I had no clue. I just was there. I was in a locked facility. I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes, who was making these decisions about my well-being and my care. It wasn't until I actually ended up in the Napa State Hospital here in Northern California when I was 21, where it was apparent that there was somebody in the city of San Francisco whose title was, I forget his job title, but basically he was the person that oversaw my conservatorship. So he would come every few months just to meet with me and meet with the hospital staff, just to check in with how I'm going and, you know, and how much longer I would be there.
We're going to take a quick break here and return to this discussion about conservatorship in just a moment. You've been listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. While we're on break, let me give you a heads up about 2 fellow local podcasters who I think you might want to know about. Did you know that about 1% of people stutter? Proud Stutter is a podcast changing the conversation about stuttering and embracing verbal diversity in an effort to change how we talk about it, one conversation at a time. The hosts, Maya, a proud person who stutters, and Cynthia, a woman who doesn't stutter, explore topics like dating with a stutter, raising a child with a stutter, and how the media can better portray people who stutter in TV, film, and radio. Stuttering comes in many forms, and it's often misunderstood. Maya and Cynthia talk to people who stutter and those that are connected to the stuttering community in an effort to help lift up the voices of the stuttering community. New episodes every other Friday. Let's get back to the story about conservatorship. When Eric was 16, he ran away from his home in a small Colorado town with 2 high school friends. He was struggling with his sexuality and his identity as a young gay person and made his way to San Francisco. He was also struggling with depression. In San Francisco, he was homeless briefly, then spent a few months living with his grandmother before heading back home to Colorado. And that's when the struggle with depression became more severe. After a suicide attempt, he was hospitalized in a psychiatric ward. He was there for a few weeks until a psychiatrist had him transferred from that ward to a state hospital. This was a locked facility, using both physical and chemical restraints on patients.
Physical restraints are typically where the staff members in the ward would in worst case scenario, to sort of tackle down a patient who was maybe being symptomatic with their mental health issues, possibly just acting out of frustration or anger. So a group of staff would tackle the patients. After being tackled down, the patients would be restrained. Often it was 4-point restraints where they put leather restraints on their wrists and on their ankles. Sometimes the restraints could be a little more, much more intensive, actually. I mean, there was masks that they would put on folks' faces to keep them from biting or spitting. Sometimes there was a belt that was placed over their middle area, the waist, to keep them from moving around and thrashing around on the bed. Chemical restraints is different in the sense that when the hospital staff felt that similar behaviors, maybe somebody was frustrated or angry or becoming symptomatic with their mental health challenges, then heavy doses of antipsychotic medication would be injected into the bodies. It was usually done in an arm or hip of the patients to heavily sedate them, and that sedation could last for hours or on end. And I mean, I had experienced physical restraint with the leather restraints, but there were a number of times I felt that I had been chemically restrained to the point I was a zombie and really did not have much awareness of what was going on at the time.
Remember that this was the 1980s, and some things have changed. These days in California, state facilities, as well as regional and certain private providers, have to report the use of chemical and physical restraints to the state. But that wasn't Eric's last stay in a state hospital. There would be two more. A few months after he turned 18, he was discharged to a halfway house. From there, he was sent to a facility for people with substance use disorders. But he says he didn't really have one. He was only experimenting like teenagers do. He never checked in, and he ended up homeless on the streets of Denver. And that's when he began developing early symptoms of schizoaffective disorder. He would wander the streets, hearing voices and having hallucinations. He was deemed gravely disabled and sent to the Fort Logan State Hospital in Denver, where he was conserved and stayed for a year and a half. And then he ended up in Napa State Hospital, here in California.
I essentially escaped from Fort Logan State Hospital. It's not as dramatic as it may sound. I did get to a point where I received ground privileges and could wander the grounds of the state hospital, and basically one day just left, went to the bank. I had a little bit of cash and made a withdrawal and flew from the Denver airport to the San Francisco airport. There, again, I ended up in San Francisco homeless for a few days and engaged in self-harm, was hospitalized, and it was during that hospital stay here in the city that it was suggested to me that I participate in what they called voluntary ECT, which otherwise known as shock treatment. And I was confused. I was young. I didn't really understand what ECT was at the time or what it entailed. And so like I said, they considered it a voluntary treatment procedure, and I agreed to that. I was in and out of states of amnesia, and I actually, you know, being aware of who I was, it was just very frightening. So I spoke with the staff, the psychiatrist, and said that I don't want to participate in this anymore. And the wording that I recall, that I was resistant to treatment, and so I was transferred from the hospital in San Francisco to the Napa State Hospital, where I remained for another year and a half.
What do you think your experience says about conservatorship in general, if it says anything?
My experiences with conservatorship, again, I wasn't even aware of the policies and the procedures that were going on behind the scenes that placed me in those facilities, the three state hospitals, and many, many psychiatric wards at the time. So it was confusing. But to be honest with you, I have to give it a lot of thought. The type of conservatorship as it currently exists, the policies that are being discussed and developed in San Francisco and the state of California, based on my experiences, I really had to struggle with how I feel about that. Again, I was somebody who was in essentially forced treatment. And then right now, currently in the year 2020, for the past 4 years, I have worked with clients who are in crisis situations, many who live with serious mental illness themselves. This is in Marin County, north of San Francisco. I've worked with hundreds of clients who have experienced very, very, very challenging situations. And I would say that the vast majority of them are able to do well and thrive with the support of peer providers, of mental health clinicians, of compassionate mental health clinicians, of family members, of you know, just community supports, they do well. And my struggle is, I think there's been one or two cases, even though I've been conserved, where I've worked with clients where it may be in their best interest because they're so, so disabled. I'm thinking in particular of a case of an older woman who we've worked with for the past few months. And not only does she live with a major mental illness, but she's also developing cognitive decline in the form of some type of dementia. And she wanders the streets into traffic, and she just is unable to take care of herself. So I've really had to think, in that type of situation, is conservatorship warranted? And the struggle is, maybe it is. I just don't know how else she could survive or thrive without some type of forced treatment, for lack of a better term. But then again, that said, like I said, I've worked with hundreds of clients in the past 4 years, and there's no reason whatsoever for any of those folks, regardless of how ill they were at the time or how many challenges that they were having, that they need to experience that type of experience that I had in a state hospital system back in the 80s.
The core tension here seems to be that mental health advocates say conservatorship is a system rife with abuse and should be abolished, or at least vastly scaled back, while supporters of conservatorship are saying, no, we need to fix the abuses and actually make it easier to conserve people who need help and aren't getting it. Usually, conservatorship is associated with aging people who might be developing various kinds of dementia, and the conservatee is a child or other loved one. But San Francisco County also conserves people, those who are determined to be gravely disabled and referred from a psychiatric hospital. And the reason why the conversation in the local public discourse is more about unsheltered people than elders is because the Housing Conservatorship Program was aimed specifically at mentally ill homeless people with substance use disorders. The kind of situation where people sometimes call 911 about a mentally disturbed person, something a lot of advocates consider problematic.
Well, mentally disturbed person, that terminology all into itself is problematic. And neighbors or people who are residents in apartments or homes or business owners, or it sounds like they're calling the police to assess a mentally disturbed person. And then they're being 5150. All I can say is that shocks me. I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, I think there needs to be a more compassionate, thoughtful, educated way to understand what the challenges that these individuals are experiencing. And to me, what it sounds like is they're essentially just being dragged off the streets, put into a hospital under 5150, assessed, returned to the streets, and this cycle goes on and on and on again, and to the point where eventually they just are put into, I'm assuming, a facility, housed in a facility under conservatorship. And to me, that's just cruel. It's a form of cruel and unusual punishment, in a sense, from my perspective. It sort of gets me wound up just knowing that that's going on in the city.
The person who petitions for and manages conservatorships in San Francisco, Jill Nielsen, told the Chronicle recently that this new program really underscores that conservatorship has to be the very last option. And a compelling case for conservatorship has to be made to a judge. Here's Supervisor Raphael Mandelman again.
In all these cases, a judge is making the decision. The potential conservatee is represented by legal counsel, at least in San Francisco, the very effective legal counsel of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. And so each element that is required of a conservatorship needs to be proven. And people are very sensitive to the deprivation, I think, particularly in San Francisco. The city staff who might be seeking the conservatorship, the public defender certainly, and the judges are all quite sensitive to what they're doing and to the gravity of taking away someone's autonomy. So in the case of a housing conservatorship, there have to be documented offers of service for each of those detentions. And the public defender can challenge any one of them. They can challenge the documentation for it. Was there really an offer? Prove it. Was it actually an offer of appropriate service? Show it. So one of the challenges in making a housing conservatorship work is the sheer like pile of evidence you have to put together. When you think about what's happening in a psych emergency room, it's chaotic. People are coming in, they're going, decisions are being made quickly. And, you know, they're always over capacity. There's too many people coming in. And so documenting this level of engagement and then letting folks know that they are potentially at risk of being conserved down the line. All of this has to happen. And then a judge has to make a number of other decisions that can get argued over between the two sets of lawyers. Is this the only way to get to take care of this person? Has everything else been tried? You know, the public defender can raise all of those arguments. Even if the person is conserved under that housing conservatorship, there's a process for the regular reassessment of whether, you know, it's still appropriate.
Mental health advocates like Eric Henriquez would prefer that things not get to this point, that the city work instead on building up voluntary services.
It's heartbreaking for me when I'm out and about in the city. I live in the city, so I see the suffering and the challenges that folks who are homeless or on the streets or live with mental health challenges and or substance use challenges experience. It's heartbreaking, and I have so much compassion for them. I personally, based on my experiences both as a former patient and now as a professional who works with folks who have major mental health challenges, for the vast majority of cases, it's just unacceptable how certain politicians, how certain residents of San Francisco, how visitors to San Francisco view the challenges and the struggles that many of these people live with. It's just so heartbreaking again. And does Eric Henriquez have suggestions for alternatives for that? Yes, I do. For example, what we do in Marin is one of our teams is called the Outreach and Engagement Team. And we go out, peer providers and clinicians go out and try to develop rapport and trust with people in Marin who may be homeless, who are struggling with mental health challenges and substance use challenges, and may be very frightened by the system or don't know anything about the system. And so we slowly and gradually develop trust and rapport with these folks to the point many of them have got to the point where they're able to function at a higher level than they did. I mean, in some cases, people become open to medication treatment. Others, it's just a wellness drop-in center where they can interact with people. We help them get set up with Medi-Cal so that they can get their medical needs met. And if they're interested, their psychiatric needs met. And just this careful, thoughtful, deliberate, ongoing approach to connecting with these individuals is just such a positive thing that I've done and been able to do in my life through my position with the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, and the outcomes often are just incredible.
You were diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. You were conserved. You were deemed by somebody to be not able to care for yourself. But now you hold a complex management role, lots of responsibility. You're a homeowner. You've been in a relationship for 24 years. Mm-hmm. What helped you get to a point where you could thrive?
It was a series of things. Very good questions. It was a series of things. I would tie a lot of my recovery from my mental health challenges with schizoaffective disorder to probably the early mid-90s when I began working with a psychologist in Denver. She and I worked together for over 20 years and did a lot of hard work together during that time that she served as my psychologist. And also, at that time, I just developed very close friends. I began with the guidance of my psychologist. I began to slowly take courses at the local college where I eventually got a bachelor's degree in social work. And through my time in college, I began to be exposed to different types of individuals than I had been exposed to in the mental health system. And so they sort of served as positive role models and very supportive of my challenges at the time. And as you mentioned, I've been in a relationship with my husband for 24 years now, and that relationship has been a foundation to my recovery, just the stability and the shared history and, you know, the ongoing ups and downs that we've worked through together over the years. It's just, you know, what it's been the support and understanding of others.
We've been talking a lot about state hospitals and how Eric's experience was in the 1980s. You may know that in the 60s, the state started a process of closing and emptying many of the mental health institutions it operated, including state hospitals. As of 2020, the hospitals that Eric stayed in were still in operation. They now function differently at much lower capacity, treating only the most severe cases. And that may in fact be part of the problem. There are not enough resources in these systems. We have a nursing bed shortage, a hospital bed shortage.
There's just a dramatic shortage of those places. And as we were talking about, there was a relatively simple system for addressing those needs 50, 60 years ago. And that was the state mental health system and the state mental hospitals, which consumed a lot of resources. They were the second largest item in the state of California's budget. But we dismantled those. And the rules around Medi-Cal reimbursement have made it so that it is very hard to, you know, intentionally difficult to have folks with severe mental health issues receive their care and treatment in nursing homes over a prolonged period of time. Everything that I've learned about kind of mental health between California and San Francisco over these last 3 years that I've been in office has led me to believe that we're just dramatically undersupplied in terms of appropriate facilities for people who are being conserved, and even for people who need a lesser level of care. And not everybody who needs to be conserved needs to be in a locked facility, but there are folks who do, and we just don't have enough places for them.
Zoom out, and you'll see that this is a huge issue, a statewide concern, and it has minimal state management.
California, although largely abandoning its responsibility for mental hospitals, you know, hasn't taken on responsibility for alternatives. So whether conservatorship is good or bad, you would think would be something that the state is interested in, and you would think the state would have some role in regulating how counties and individuals participate in conservatorship, but there's no state office of conservatorship, which I think is kind of nuts. It's all left to individual counties to work it out. You could conceivably have a very coercive county that was, you know, probably over-conserving, and you could also have a very, you know, a county that wasn't particularly interested in using this tool at all and wasn't providing necessary care to people. I think there's a real need for more state kind of guidance and also oversight to sort of be looking at how are the counties using this tool? Are they doing it to the extent that they should? And is the problem that they don't have the resources and the state should be thinking about how to fund more appropriate placements for folks who the counties really ought to be conserving?
As far as the Mad Mob and other mental health advocates are concerned, the whole concept needs to be rethought.
I really feel that this whole discussion needs to be scrapped, and the whole conversation needs to be completely rethought out from a more humane perspective. And I don't have the answers for that. I mean, all I can say is based on my personal experience working with this population, that there's much more proactive and thoughtful ways to address the needs of folks who are struggling and suffering.
That's a big conversation to entirely reshape. It involves the state, various counties, and the different departments in those counties, like the Public Defender's Office, the Human Services Agency, the Board of Supervisors, the Health Department, and community-based organizations. A new ordinance about conservatorship is working its way through the state legislature, and this local pilot program is being evaluated. So I plan to come back to this and give you an update on how this conversation goes. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Civic comes to you from KSFP LP at 102.5 FM in San Francisco. Our theme music is by John Dillon. Our team includes producer and contributor Mel Baker and assistant producer Liana Wilcox. Civic airs Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. on KSFP. New episodes every Thursday. Thanks for listening.